Chapter 4. Mr. Riley gives his advice concerning a school for Tom, the gentleman in the ample white cravat and shirt frill, taking his brandy and water so pleasantly with his good friend Tulliver, is Mr. Riley, a gentleman with a waxen complexion and fat hands, rather highly educated for an auctioneer and appraiser, but large-hearted enough to show a great deal of bonhomie toward simple country acquaintances of hospitable habits. Mr. Riley spoke of such acquaintances kindly as people of the old school. The conversation had come to a pause. Mr. Tulliver, not without a particular reason, had abstained from a seventh recital of the cool retort by which Riley had shown himself too many for Dick's, and how Whackum had had his comb cut for once in his life. Now the business of the dam had been settled by arbitration, and how there never would have been any dispute at all about the height of water if everybody was what they should be, and old Harry hadn't made the lawyers. Mr. Tulliver was, on the whole, a man of safe traditional opinions, but on one or two points he had trusted to his unassisted intellect, and had arrived at several questionable conclusions. Amongst the rest, that rats, weevils, and lawyers were created by old Harry. Unhappily he had no one to tell him that this was rampant Manicheism, else he might have seen his error. But today it was clear that the good principle was triumphant. This affair of the water power had been a tangled business somehow, for all it seemed look at it one way as plain as water's water. But, big a puzzle as it was, it hadn't got the better of Riley. Mr. Tulliver took his brandy and water a little stronger than usual, and, for a man who might be supposed to have a few hundreds lying idle at his banker's, was rather incautiously open in expressing his high estimate of his friend's business talents. But the dam was a subject of conversation that would keep. It could always be taken up again at the same point, and exactly in the same condition. And there was another subject, as you know, on which Mr. Tulliver was in pressing want of Mr. Riley's advice. This was his particular reason for remaining silent for a short space after his last draft, and rubbing his knees in a meditative manner. He was not a man to make an abrupt transition. This was a puzzling world, as he often said, and if you drive your wagon in a hurry, you may light on an awkward corner. Mr. Riley, meanwhile, was not impatient. Why should he be? Even Hotspur, one would think, must have been patient in his slippers on a warm hearth, taking copious snuff, and sipping gratuitous brandy and water. There's a thing I've got in my head, said Mr. Tulliver at last, in rather a lower tone than usual, as he turned his head and looked steadfastly at his companion. Ah! Said Mr. Riley, in a tone of mild interest. He was a man with heavy waxen eyelids and high arched eyebrows, looking exactly the same under all circumstances. This immovability of face, and the habit of taking a pinch of snuff, before he gave an answer, made him trebly oracular to Mr. Tulliver. It's a very particular thing, he went on. It's about my boy Tom. At the sound of this name, Maggie, who was seated on a low stool close by the fire, with a large book open on her lap, shook her heavy hair back and looked up eagerly. There were few sounds that roused Maggie when she was dreaming over her book, but Tom's name served as well as the shrillest whistle. In an instant she was on the watch, with gleaming eyes, like a sky terrier suspecting mischief, or at all events determined to fly at anyone who threatened it toward Tom. You see, I want to put him to a new school at midsummer, said Mr. Tulliver. He's coming away from the academy at Lady Day, and I shall let him run loose for a quarter, but after that I want to send him to a downright good school, where they'll make a shallard of him. Well, said Mr. Riley, there's no greater advantage you can give him than a good education. Not, he added, with polite significance, odd that a man can't be an excellent miller and farmer, and a shrewd, sensible fellow into the bargain, without much help from the schoolmaster. I believe you, said Mr. Tulliver, winking, and turning his head on one side. But that's where it is. I don't mean Tom to be a miller and farmer. I see no fun I that. Why, if I made him a miller and farmer, he'd be expectant to take to the mill and the land, and a hinting at me as it was time for me to lay by, and think o' my latter end. Nay, I've seen enough o' that, why sons. I'll never pull my coat off before I go to bed. I shall give Tom an education, and put him to a business, as he may make a nest for himself, and not want to push me out o' mine. Pretty well if he gets it, when I'm dead and gone. I shan't be put off why spoon meat afore I've lost my teeth. This was evidently a point on which Mr. Tulliver felt strongly, and the impetus which had given unusual rapidity and emphasis to his speech showed itself still unexhausted for some minutes afterward in a defiant motion of the head from side to side, and an occasional nay, like a subsiding growl. These angry symptoms were keenly observed by Maggie, and cut her to the quick. Tom, it appeared, was supposed capable of turning his father out of doors, and of making the future in some way tragic by his wickedness. This was not to be borne, and Maggie jumped up from her stool, forgetting all about her heavy book, which fell with a bang within the fender, and going up between her father's knees, said, in a half-crying, half-indignant voice, Father, Tom wouldn't be naughty to you ever. I know he wouldn't. Mrs. Tulliver was out of the room superintending a choice supper dish, and Mr. Tulliver's heart was touched, so Maggie was not scolded about the book. Mr. Riley quietly picked it up and looked at it, while the father laughed, with a certain tenderness in his hard-lined face, and patted his little girl on the back, and then held her hands, and kept her between his knees. What? They mustn't say any harm, O Tom, eh? Said Mr. Tulliver, looking at Maggie with a twinkling eye. Then, in a lower voice, turning to Mr. Riley, as though Maggie couldn't hear, she understands what one's talking about so as never was. And you should hear her read, straight off, as if she knowed it all beforehand. And delays at her book. But it's bad, Mr. Tulliver added sadly, checking this blamable exultation. A woman's no business why being so clever, it'll turn to trouble, I doubt. But bless you. Here the exultation was clearly recovering the mastery, he'll read the books, and understand them better nor half the folks as are growed up. Maggie's cheeks began to flush with triumphant excitement. She thought Mr. Riley would have a respect for her now, it had been evident that he thought nothing of her before. Mr. Riley was turning over the leaves of the book, and she could make nothing of his face, with its high arched eyebrows. But he presently looked at her, and said, Come, and tell me something about this book. Here are some pictures. I want to know what they mean. Maggie, with deepening color, went without hesitation to Mr. Riley's elbow and looked over the book, eagerly seizing one corner, and tossing back her mane, while she said, Oh, I'll tell you what that means. It's a dreadful picture, isn't it? But I can't help looking at it. That old woman in the water's a witch. They've put her in to find out whether she's a witch or no. And if she swims, she's a witch. And if she's drowned and killed, you know she's innocent. And not a witch, but only a poor silly old woman. But what good would it do her then, you know, when she was drowned? Only, I suppose, she'd go to heaven, and God would make it up to her. And this dreadful blacksmith with his arms akimbo, laughing, Oh, isn't he ugly? I'll tell you what he is. He's the devil really. Here Maggie's voice became louder and more emphatic, and not a right blacksmith. For the devil takes the shape of wicked men, and walks about and sets people doing wicked things, and he's oftener in the shape of a bad man than any other, because, you know, if people saw he was the devil, and he roared at them, they'd run away, and he couldn't make them do what he pleased. Mr. Tulliver had listened to this exposition of Maggie's with petrifying wonder. Why, what book is it the wench has got hold on? He burst out at last. The History of the Devil, apostrophe by Daniel Defoe, not quite the right book for a little girl, said Mr. Riley. How came it among your books, Mr. Tulliver? Maggie looked hurt and discouraged, while her father said, Why, it's one of the books I bought at Partridge's sale. They was all bound alike. It's a good binding, you see, and I thought they'd be all good books. There's Jeremy Taylor's Holy Living and Dying among them. I read in it often of a Sunday. Mr. Tulliver felt somehow a familiarity with that great writer, because his name was Jeremy, and there's a lot more of them, sermons mostly, I think, but they've all got the same covers, and I thought they were all one sample, as you may say. But it seems one mustn't judge by th outside. This is a puzzling world. Well, said Mr. Riley, in an admonitory, patronizing tone as he patted Maggie on the head, I advise you to put by the History of the Devil, apostrophe and read some prettier book. Have you no prettier books? Oh, yes, said Maggie, reviving a little in the desire to vindicate the variety of her reading. I know the reading in this book isn't pretty, but I like the pictures, and I make stories to the pictures out of my own head, you know. But I've got Aesop's Fables, apostrophe and a book about kangaroos and things, and The Pilgrim's Progress. Apostrophe, ah, a beautiful book, said Mr. Riley. You can't read a better. Well, but there's a great deal about the devil in that, said Maggie, triumphantly, and I'll show you the picture of him in his true shape, as he fought with Christian. Maggie ran in an instant to the corner of the room, jumped on a chair, and reached down from the small bookcase a shabby old copy of Bunyan, which opened at once, without the least trouble of search, at the picture she wanted. Here he is, she said, running back to Mr. Riley, and Tom colored him for me with his paints, when he was at home last holidays, the body all black, you know, and the eyes red, like fire, because he's all fire inside, and it shines out at his eyes. Go, go, said Mr. Tulliver, peremptorily, beginning to feel rather uncomfortable at these free remarks on the personal appearance of a being powerful enough to create lawyers. Shut up the book, and let's hear no more o' such talk. It is as I thought, the child'll learn more mischief nor good why the books. Go, go, and see after your mother. Maggie shut up the book at once, with a sense of disgrace, but not being inclined to see after her mother, she calm promised the matter by going into a dark corner behind her father's chair, and nursing her doll, toward which as he had an occasional fit of fondness in Tom's absence, neglecting its toilet, but lavishing so many warm kisses on it, that the waxen cheeks had a wasted unhealthy appearance. Did you ever hear the like, aunt? Said Mr. Tulliver, as Maggie retired. Aye, it's a pity, but what she'd been a lad, she'd ha' been a match for the lawyers, she would. It's the wonderfulst thing here, he lowered his voice as I picked the mother, because she wasn't or cute being a good-looking woman too, and come of a rare family for managing, but I picked her from her sister's o' purpose, cause she was a bit weak-like, for I wasn't a-goin' to be told the right so things by my own fireside. But you see, when a man's got brains himself, there's no knowing where they'll run to, and a pleasant sort o' soft woman may go on breeding you stupid lads and cute wenches, till it's like, as if the world was turned topsy-turvy. It's an uncommon puzzling thing. Mr. Riley's gravity gave way, and he shook a little under the application of his pinch of snuff before he said, But your lad's not stupid, is he? I saw him, when I was here last, busy making fishing tackle. He seemed quite up to it. Well, he isn't not to say stupid. He's got a notion o' things out o' door, and a sort o' common sense, as he'd lay hold o' things by the right handle. But he's slow with his tongue, you see, and he reads but poorly, and can't abide the books, and spells all wrong, they tell me, and as shy as can be why strangers. And you never hear him say cute things like the little wench. Now, what I want, is to send him to a school, where they'll make him a bit nimble with his tongue and his pen, and make a smart chap of him. I want my son, to be even why these fellows as have got the start o' me with having better schooling. Not, but what, if the world had been left as God made it, I could ha' seen my way, and held my own why the best of them. But things have got so twisted round, and wrapped up by unreasonable words, as aren't a bit like 'em, as I'm clean at fault, often and often. Everything winds about, so the more straightforward you are, the more you're puzzled. Mr. Tulliver took a draught, swallowed it slowly, and shook his head in a melancholy manner, conscious of exemplifying the truth, that a perfectly sane intellect is hardly at home in this insane world. You're quite in the right of it, Tulliver, observed Mr. Riley. Better spend an extra 100 or 200 on your son's education, than leave it him in your will. I know I should have tried to do so by a son of mine, if I'd had one, though, God knows, I haven't the ready money to play with, Tulliver, and I have a houseful of daughters into the bargain. I dare say, now, you know of a school as 'ud be just the thing for Tom, said Mr. Tulliver, not diverted from his purpose by any sympathy with Mr. Riley's deficiency of ready cash. Mr. Riley took a pinch of snuff, and kept Mr. Tulliver in suspense by a silence that seemed deliberative, before he said, I know of a very fine chance for anyone that's got the necessary money, and that's what you have, Tulliver. The fact is, I wouldn't recommend any friend of mine to send a boy to a regular school if he could afford to do better. But if anyone wanted his boy to get superior instruction and training, where he would be the companion of his master, and that master a first-rate fellow, I know his man. I wouldn't mention the chance to everybody, because I don't think everybody would succeed in getting it if he were to try, but I mention it to you, Tulliver, between ourselves. The fixed inquiring glance with which Mr. Tulliver had been watching his friend's oracular face became quite eager. Hey, now, let's hear, he said, adjusting himself in his chair with the complacency of a person who is thought worthy of important communications. He's an Oxford man, said Mr. Riley, sententiously, shutting his mouth close, and looking at Mr. Tulliver, to observe the effect of this stimulating information. What? A parson? Said Mr. Tulliver, rather doubtfully. Yes, and an M. A. The bishop, I understand, thinks very highly of him. Why, it was the bishop who got him his present curacy. Ah? Said Mr. Tulliver, to whom one thing was as wonderful as another concerning these unfamiliar phenomena. Be but what can he want? Why, Tom, then? Why, the fact is, he's fond of teaching, and wishes to keep up his studies, and a clergyman has but little opportunity for that in his parochial duties. He's willing to take one or two boys as pupils to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.